Welcome to the Cynic Podcast, a weekly discussion of current events in China. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Today, we're going to do something slightly different. Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danwei.com, is going to take over hosting duty, and I'll hop into the guest seat as we discuss the music industry in China. Joining us here, we have two terrific guests, both mainstays of the music scene here in China, with both domestic and international perspective on things. We've got Archie Hamilton, Managing Director of Splitworks, which has organized music festivals and brought a number of artists to China from abroad. Welcome to the show, Archie.
Thanks, Kaiser. Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Michael.
You just spoiled my other guest. We've got Michael Pettis, who is not wearing his economist hat today, but he's appearing instead in the guise or in the form of the owner of D22, a very popular music club here in Beijing. He's also head of the indie label Maybe Mars. Michael, wonderful that you could join us, and we're going to have you on another time to talk about economics.
Great. Thanks very much, Kaiser.
So with that, I'm going to hand off to Jeremy here. Jeremy, do your worst.
I certainly will do that. Let's start with introducing all of you, because you all have very different backgrounds in the Chinese music industry. Archie, could you introduce how you arrived in China doing music?
For sure, yeah. I arrived in 2005 and spent 6 months acquainting myself, and then launched a series of branded events with international artists, culminating in a festival in Shanghai in 2007, where I lost my shirt and my house and my kid's shirt and everything else. We have a couple of festivals. We promoted around 300 shows in China with both domestic and international artists. We've worked in about 30 cities, and we're pretty happy with what we see.
Great, thank you. Michael, how about you? Because you do wear two hats and are well known for both of them. Let's just focus on the music.
Thanks. Archie didn't mention that he's produced many of the most interesting shows that have happened in China, so I'll mention it for him. I got to China in 2002 and started haunting the various clubs, et cetera, in Beijing, and started bringing musicians over, I think, in 2004, 2005. Mostly guys like Elliot Sharp and people like that, people that I knew in the old days in New York. And then in 2005, I opened D22 in the Wudaoko area. And I'm always wobbly on the dates, I think in 2008, we started, a number of our bands started pestering us about putting out their CDs. So we started Maybe Mars Bing Ma Su, and both of those things continue to run, and as Archie implied, continue to lose money.
Yes, I think that may be a regular theme tonight. Kaiser, how about you?
I may be the only person here who hasn't actually lost money on music, but that's because I've kept the whole business end of it at a good distance. I've been involved in the music scene really since the fall of 1988. I came here directly after graduating college and immediately fell in with a bunch of long-haired miscreants and started playing in a band called, that we eventually, by the spring of 89, was called Tang Dynasty, Tang Chao. We enjoyed a modicum of success, we were probably the most successful and influential heavy metal band, and really the first heavy metal band in China. I left that band. I played sporadically with them through the early 90s and rejoined from 96 to 99, left that band in 99, was helping out with some other bands, including a band called Thin Man, and then in 2001, I started a new band called Chunqiu, Spring and Autumn. Actually, it's a spring and autumn song that you hear at the beginning of this program. And I've been playing with them ever since and not involving myself in any way with music except as a musician. It's a good way to do it.
Thank you, guys. Now, I am hosting, but you kindly prepared some questions for me. The first one is rather interesting. What ails the Chinese music industry? So let's get straight into it. What's wrong with the Chinese music industry? Let's start with Michael.
Well, I may be overly optimistic here. I'm not terribly worried about what's wrong with the Chinese music industry. For me, what's happening, what's been happening, is actually fairly right, in the sense that it seems to me that it's been developing very, very quickly. When you look on the talent side, the number of artists that are coming out, the number of interesting young musicians that are coming out, are really astonishing. The big problem that we have is that the scene has grown much more quickly than the audience. But I think that's a problem that sort of rights itself over the next 5, 6, 7 years. I'm very pleased and very optimistic with the especially the Beijing music scene.
Archie.
Yeah, I mean, similarly to Michael, I think it's important to define the music industry in China. I think there are two very distinct segments. One is the very established, very mainstream entertainment scene, which is based more on the culture of celebrity than actual musical talent.
But we're not talking about that, right?
We're not talking about that. Of course.
Come on, that's my favorite part.
I think it's important to talk about that in the context of there's a music industry everywhere in the world, and there's a pop music industry, and there's generally a subculture music industry in reaction to that. And I think what's happened over the last 20 years, probably, you know, since you started, has been this emergence of subcultures in opposition to this mainstream scene. And, you know, I think what we're seeing now is you know, with the rise of the internet and social media and access, is that these two scenes, which were very, very much kind of diametrically opposed, are coming closer together. And there are elements of pop infusing elements of the underground and elements of the underground infusing pop. And what we're seeing is a real crucible at this moment in time where it's coming together so quickly that, you know, a band like Bigger Bang, who was signed by Modern Sky 3 years ago, very, very young, very new band, just cut an ad for a Ford commercial, a mainstream TV ad in China. And that is almost unprecedented. I mean, you know, 3 years ago, there would have been absolutely no possibility of that whatsoever. And so, you know, in terms of what ails the music industry in China, it's, you know, similar to Michael, it's a very exciting time. There's a lot of money going into entertainment per se, and the music industry is becoming a beneficiary of that.
Kaiser.
Well, I think that you're both right. I think that we're seeing the market expand now, hopefully at the expense of the syrupy canto pop stuff. And we're seeing sort of more acceptance of rock among the popular audiences, but it's still a minuscule market.
Not just pop, not just rock. It's electronic. It's hip hop.
Sure. Okay, let's say, I mean, you know, non mainstream pop.
Sure.
And I mean, the sector that I'm specifically interested in, of course, is rock. Because I see no difference between electronica and pop myself, But for rock, I think we're still talking about minuscule audiences. I mean, some of the really huge bands can pack a decent sized stadium, but for the rest of us, we're condemned to forever play these 400 or 500 seat venues, and it's simply a function of the fact that, I mean, it's not something that most people embrace. I just don't encounter Chinese people often enough who are truly rapturously transported from the experience of listening to music. I think that music is something pretty peripheral to their lives. You don't see them. You don't see music leading sort of you know, identity among a lot of Chinese youth. It's not. It's a trapping. I mean, we've talked about this before, Archie. How, you know, the music that sells the most units in China, the one that makes money is the collar ringback tone, right? Mm-hmm. Which is something that you pay for, but you don't actually listen to yourself. You're just, you know, it's this crap, really low-res thing that you put on your phone so that somebody calling you. Yeah, exactly. It just sort of identifies you as you know, belonging to
the mainstream. So, Kaiser, I mean, to sum up, essentially, that most Chinese people are not interested in rock music,
right,
or
give
band
a fuck
music.
About rock, right, exactly.
But again, I'd agree with you in part, but I think the speed of change is incredible. I mean, I on the way here, I was discussing with a friend who's over here from the US, and I was talking about the Jambayan Music Festival, okay, which launched 2 years ago. We went the first year to review it. You know, it was the first time that there had been an outland, you know, a non kind of urban. Well, I mean, not the first time, but the first time close to Beijing that someone had tried to do a festival, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours outside in the real countryside, and there were about 4,000 or 5,000 people there.
Right.
By all the accounts that I've heard, last weekend there were well, I've heard between 50,000 and 300,000 people.
Good Lord, really?
Yeah.
And well, this time, I mean, they had some much bigger name acts.
They did, but I think the acts, you know, you're saying that people aren't interested in bands or music. All of the bands on that stage, they may have been a little bit more syrupy than what we personally would like. But it's Xue.
Right. Well, Xue is a huge name.
Though. It's Wang Feng. Yeah, they're proper musicians. They play with bands who don't play cantopop, mandopop, whatever you want to say. And Sui Zhen, of course. But, you know, we're talking between 50 and 100,000 people and 300,000 people. I mean, it was scary.
That's amazing.
Let me add something to that, because I think what's important is not the size of the audience, but the rate of growth. I mean, you could have argued in the U.S. in 1963, who the hell would come to show up at a Bob Dylan concert or any of the other really great stuff that was percolating. What really happened was that by the end of the decade, suddenly there was this huge audience driven in large part by explosive growth among the young audience, the big generation gap that existed in the United States in the 1960s, which, by the way, even exists in an even more extreme form here in China. So that's really key. I would separate two things. I would say there's the issue of the music and then there's the issue of the audience. As far as the music goes, I may be overly excited, but I honestly think Beijing has one of the best music scenes in the world. The quality of the musicians coming out is astonishing. The audience is not there yet, but it's growing very quickly. And if I could be crass for a moment, in 2006, I remember having a discussion with Joyside, which at the time was one of the most important of the underground bands in China. And they were doing a lot of shows, and I asked them, how much money do you make a month? And they said, roughly 2,000 kwai a month for about 5 or 6 shows a month.
Oh, Lord.
And I said, fine. Okay, now I'm going to hire you for 2,000 kwai a month. You're not allowed to do any shows unless I approve. And what I wanted to do was to reduce the number of shows and force their
audience sizes up.
Yeah. Yeah. And very, very quickly, people started paying 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 kwai for a Joyside show, which I think is only fair. They're a great band. Well, now, in a period of less than 2 months, thanks in large part to Archie, a band like Car Sick Cars is going to make 90,000 kwai. 4 or 5 years ago, that was completely unimaginable.
Yeah, I mean the first show that we did in 2006 with Maxima Park, a Western band, you know, we pulled Queensy Big Shark onto the bill. You know, we were excited by Modern Sky, by what they were doing. We were excited by Queensy Big Shark, who were probably their most attractive band, both in terms of the music, the musical output, the image, the attitude. And, you know, we paid them 1,000 kwai to warm up. Now we tried to book them for our festival, which we have going on in Shanghai and Beijing, and you know it's well into 6 figures renminbi.
Wow, very good.
And
they have the best album title of all time.
Right? they do.
Queen of F-ing everything.
No, that's subs, dude.
Oh, that's subs. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay,
that's all good. But I mean I think the point is that like everything in China, you know, everything is on steroids at the moment. And
but I'm sorry, guys, I have to, you know. React to this. It's the rock scene, the music scene is not on steroids compared to everything else in China. It's bigger than it was when I first arrived here in 1995. There is a bigger audience.
But it hasn't
but
been growing.
The rate of growth has not matched any the growth of anything else, whether it's cappuccinos available, cars.
There were three and okay, I mean, I know we're going to talk about this later, and I know that music festivals is a big thing. But by music festivals is kind of what we specialize in, and by the measurement of the music festival in China, there were 3 music festivals in China, give or take, in 2007, probably 2 in 2006, and I would guess there are around 100 to 170 this year.
And let me add to that, we've done tours with our bands of 25 to 30 cities in China, and I mean, I don't know what it was like when you were doing this kind of stuff, but 25 to 30 cities for an underground band, that was probably
really tough
to do.
Yeah, absolutely
5 years
terrific.
Ago.
I mean, it's rare now even for a band to be able to do 10, 15 cities, which is typically what we'd be doing now. There is a circuit now. I mean, it's amazing. There are actually clubs in all the major cities.
Although the government is closing a lot of those down.
Oh, that's really too bad.
But going back to your point, Jeremy, you know, it's not on steroids compared to
anything else.
But from the base that it was, I mean, when I arrived, but you know, when Michael arrived and when Kaiser started, I mean, God, I don't think I was born then. Sorry, Kaiser, but
you're not that young, and he's not that old, Archie.
Sorry, but honestly, you know, we're coming from such a low base. You know, such a low base. The activity is huge, and it's very recent as well. You know, whereas Cars is like,
let's just tack straight to festivals. I think, because I think this is an interesting question. Why are there so many festivals now in China?
Government money, yeah. Mostly. I was asked in 2009 by a research and insight company in Shanghai about trends in music in China, and they asked me for my prediction. I think this was the end of 2008, and they asked me for my prediction for 2009. And MIDI had just been invited by Jinjiang to do MIDI Jinjiang.
Right, we played that first
time. Yeah, and that was the first time that a local government had basically paid for a music festival to happen in their town to drive tourist dollars.
Not the first time. Xinxiang in Henan used to do that in the late
90s. Sure, and I think in Lijiang, Snow Mountain was set up
pretty much for that
as well. But in terms of a commercial kind of product launch, that was a real kickstart, because everyone talked about it. You know, it was MIDI. It was the big bad brother of Chinese music festivals going somewhere else. And suddenly every municipality in China
wanted a piece of this.
Has gone, that was great. You know, are we allowed to swear on this show?
We are.
Okay, cool.
It sometimes gets beeped because Apple censors. But,
but you know, this was the start of you know, and I you know, it actually doesn't make me very happy at the moment because I can't imagine how many taxpayers' dollars are going down the tubes of.
But so, I mean, I'm sorry, I have to go back to your point. Then the number of music festivals then is not a measurement of anything to do with the music scene. It's government dumping money.
But isn't everything government?
Stimulus.
Isn't,
but it's not coming from consumers.
Yes, if you want to compare the growth to all the other growing things in China, well, everything is growing because of
the government.
And Kaiser, wait till you hear me talk about that.
Yeah, no, okay. Michael, we'll stop you there. Let's go back to the festivals, though. So, okay, there's government money going into festivals. There are more festivals. Is something interesting coming out of it in terms of music or in terms of audience?
It's creating a viable music industry outside of TV and celebrity. It's creating a live.
Is that happening for your bands, Michael?
Yes. Like I said, we do far bigger tours now than we ever did in the past. And granted, some of the cities you show up in, and 20 kids will show up to see the show. But that's a key part of developing the scene, because basically in a lot of the secondary cities, it's going to be a small group of opinion leaders that first turn on to the music, and then it's going to spread from there. That's always how it's happened. That's how it happened in the States, in England, and in everywhere else, and that's how it's going to happen here. But the key thing to me is, you know, whatever happens, whatever we decide the rate of growth of the audience is, ultimately what's going to drive it is the quality of the music.
Sure.
And there I have zero doubt that what we've seen in China in the last few years has been really spectacular. I don't even remember anymore the names of all the good young bands that are coming out of my club. 5 years ago, I knew them all. Last night, I saw two really good bands, and I can't even tell you their names. There are so many good young bands coming out of everywhere, experimental musicians, everything. So that's going to build an audience.
And a lot more scenes developing off the back of that. A lot more. I mean, I think one of the moments that I realized there was real progress, and again, you know, it seems like me and Michael sharing a microphone is like some kind of mutual love-in or something, but you know,
well, I do love you.
I do love you too. But when I saw Bird Striking, who are maybe Mars band, basically being influenced by Car Sick Cars as opposed to a foreign band, you know, because in my experience, you know, a lot of the bands prior to that had been influenced by international bands, but suddenly here there was an underground band influencing another.
Well, you all are new here. I mean, this has been happening for a long time. I mean, there were so many bands that in the early 90s that took all of their cues from the early progenitors.
From Tang Dynasty.
From Tang Dynasty.
The only
importantly from Sui Jian and from... You know.
But I think what happened, Kaiser, is that around, you know, everyone dates it to around 2000, which is maybe just a very convenient round year. But around that time, people started saying that for the first time, maybe because of the internet or for whatever other reason, suddenly Chinese musicians started hearing everything, whether it was bebop, jazz, or MSIN, or Phil Oaks, or whatever. And it seemed to me when I first came to China that the bands that I was listening to, every single one of them, if you ask them for their influences, it was always, The Fall or Velvet Underground or somebody foreign. And, you know, Archie and I have discussed this. For me, this was a real important moment. It was a real epiphany when I started seeing young Chinese come to the club because they wanted to meet Snapline or because they wanted to meet Car Sick Cars. Suddenly, those were their idols instead of, in the generation of Snapline and Car Sick Cars, Americans or British bands. And I think that's very, very important in the development of the scene.
But I'd also agree with Kaiser that you know, again, me and Michael are speaking from a very 2000s perspective. And, you know, I've read a lot about the 90s and, you know, Lucky Bar and the scene.
Get Lucky.
Get Lucky, sorry.
It was huge. It was huge for a while. I mean, and that's what I've never really quite understood is what went wrong. I mean, because, we started in 89, we got signed in 91, 92, 93, 94. These were amazing years. The Rock Records was here with their Moyen label, their Magic Stone label, and they had signed people.
And,
like
they've
this,
just
Joey
done
and
that bird's nest thing. You know, I mean, 100,000 people are.
Let me throw in something that may be a little bit politically sensitive, but, you know, you talk about 92, 93, 94. Those were really difficult years for the Chinese economy. In fact, a lot of people think that we may have come pretty close to a collapse in 93, 94. So maybe there is some connection between the underlying economy and the interest people have in the arts and issues like that.
Right,
and if that's the case, then we may see
for sure, yeah.
We may see a resurgence.
What we see in the West, you know, ironically, is you know, and this is what I'm seeing in sharp contrast, particularly with a. And I'm going to steal your thunder, Kaiser. I'm really sorry, man. But with a band like Demerit, who, you know, we took on at two years ago, basically, this mission to take them to America. Because here was a great band, a really amazing band, who had no future, really, in China. Because punk died. You know, punk was punk and metal.
See, they're not just punk, though. That's what I like about them.
Sure, but okay, hard, angry music seemed to die at the end of the 2000s because the economy took off and suddenly we were surrounded, particularly in Shanghai, by you know, this sort of R&B, hip-hop, soft, rock, cop, whatever you want to call it, money, women, cars.
It, right?
Whereas in America, which is struggling unbelievably at the moment, you know, punk, metal, people are angry. You know, people are in the West are angry that they're like, you know, fuck our government, you know, fuck the system. Let's get together and talk politics and go crazy. And here, everyone seemed, well, particularly for the last sort of five or six years, everyone's been happy and positive and believing in the future. So the music reflects that state of mind.
I've just had an epiphany I think I understand Michael Pettis now. I mean, your bearish economic outlook is inextricably intertwined with, I mean, you're basically betting on a flourishing of rock because the economy is going to go down the tube.
Michael Pettis is in fact trying to short the global economy
exactly.
In order
economy to make rock flourish in China. And I'm down with that, man. I'm down with that. Sign me up.
Okay, well, I'll take your guys' word for it about the health of the Chinese music industry. Count me a cynic when it comes to rock and band music, hip-hop. But let's move on to a discussion of something particular, piracy. What is piracy's effect on the Chinese music industry? And let's look at it in a complex way, because, in fact, the way you first phrased the question to me, Kaiser, was, is piracy good or bad? So there obviously have been some good effects of piracy.
I definitely think so. I think Michael actually touched on one of them just now when he was talking about the impact of the internet in 2000 as maybe a tipping point. The exposure, the sudden exposure of all these bands to all of this music from around the world. This could not have happened if it weren't for the Dahou Dai phenomenon, you know, the Dahou CDs, the Saugashed CDs yes. that came in during the mid-90s. I think that it's true for, you know, the film industry where I think if the directors and the film producers and screenwriters hadn't been exposed to so much pirated content, they wouldn't have elevated the art as well as they did. They saw suddenly a higher bar. Same with musicians. They suddenly understood how music ought to sound. I mean, production improved. The quality of playing improved. Just their horizons expanded. Mike, would you agree with that?
Yeah, and, you know, as a CD label owner, of course, I'm opposed to piracy, but I don't lose a lot of sleep over it. It was only really in the 1950s that musicians started making money from recordings, and music yet managed to survive before the 1950s. What it means is that we're going to figure out a different model, and perhaps we're going to move much more towards live shows, and CDs will be like LPs, like vinyl was in the 1920s and 30s, just your calling card. You didn't make money from it. You made money from your live shows. And honestly, it's hard for me to see that as a bad thing. I would love to go back to the days when everything occurred live.
I'd take that one stage further. I was going to agree that, you know, for me, piracy is a somewhat outmoded paradigm. You know, there's been this big debate in the West predominantly about, you know, this idea of ownership versus rental. And, you know, Netflix approved it in the DVD category. They've just basically tripled the cost of their DVDs to stop having to stock, you know, physical round plastic objects and send them out and get them sent back in favor of streaming. And these various services that have been stymied by the major labels, you know, dinosaurs that they are finally getting some traction. And, you know, it's about elegance and simplicity. You know, if you can provide a service that is cheap enough and easy enough for people to use, they'll use it. And Spotify has proved that in Europe, and I think we'll now go on and prove it in the US.
Well, let's look at Spotify and similar services, cloud music, if you will, the heavenly jukebox where you can call up any song you want. Is that going to work in China?
Well, I mean, I think, it's, you know, again, we can't really get away from it, can we, Kaiser? We're going to have to plug.
No, you can't.
No, we can't. But we're going to have to plug Ting at some point, you know.
Well, let's talk about Ting. Full disclosure first.
Of course.
Kaiser.
I work for Baidu, which, of course, recently signed a major landmark deal with three major labels, with Universal, with Warner, and with Sony, whereby they're going to be providing their full global catalogs, and we're still going to make that completely accessible for free to our users. And, of course, it's supported
by advertising. You need a Chinese IP address.
That's right. You need a Chinese IP address, so you're shit out of luck if you're not in China.
Can I ask a question?
Of course you can.
So, you know, full disclosure, we've just scored the head of development for Ting for our conference.
Catherine Leung, right.
Yeah, Catherine Leung for our conference. So I probably won't be as
critical as you would be if you weren't completely co-opted.
You said it.
I can also edit you out of this.
Okay, so my view of that a little bit is you know, you say it's a landmark deal, but as far as I was aware, Google Music had done the same thing 3 years ago. You know, had signed deals with all four major labels to distribute content for free, ad supported in China. Is that right? Or
that
wrong?
Is correct. No, that is correct.
Okay, so
they just never approached us in terms of the scale of
it's not landmark because Baidu is doing it, not
correct,
because of what it is.
Should we repeat the disclosure? No, I mean, I think this is the interesting fact. You know, Google is largely irrelevant. I mean, not largely irrelevant. I mean, they hold 23% of search in China or something like that. I don't know the updated statistics. But they're not irrelevant. But in terms of scale, you know, Baidu is obviously huge. And I think the landmark that Kaiser's referring to is the fact that a company who have, you know,
traditionally
resisted,
been vilified by that, right.
Resisted the calls of the establishment to legitimize what's going on.
That's not exactly fair either. I mean, from 2007, we've had deals with EMI, with Rock, with all these other labels in the region. It's really only the three who've just recently signed with
okay,
us.
Okay, cloud fanboys, stop. Michael yeah. Pettis, you manage actual bands that play music. Is this going to make any difference to you?
I may be very naive. To me, that's really irrelevant. We're going to figure it out at some point. And what really matters is, as far as I'm concerned, what really matters is that lots of people in China and in the world know who Xiao He is, know who Karsik Kars are, know who PK-14, Rustic. That's what's important for me. However we figure it out is pretty secondary.
I think, you know, ultimately music has an intrinsic value. And, you know, we seem to be at the bottom of a U-curve almost, you know, where I think one of the major problems in the West, and I think that we're at the bottom of the U-curve because in the West, you know, you can see again. I'm using festivals as a proxy because it's what I know best. But you know, the headliners of most festivals in the West now are mostly legacy record label investment. And what's beginning to happen now is the independent bands who didn't have that record label kind of crutch have started scaling those heights. And so now we're starting to hit the reverse kind of upward part of this U curve. And to Michael's point, you know, it's only been 50 years since recorded music was valuable, you know. And we reached this nadir in 2000 where the music industry was just a horrible, horrible, horrible place. You know, it was full of people who didn't give a shit about music anymore. They wanted money. They wanted sex. They wanted drugs. I mean, it's still.
That's changed.
Yeah, maybe that's somewhat naive.
That's why I'm in this.
but there was an I think the musicians have always been into that as well as their music. But there was this whole cancerous industry that had no talent, had no. I mean, there's this great book called Kill Your Friends, which I would recommend everyone to read, which is basically a parody of a makeup music executive at the end of the 90s who just, it's just a crazy book. But, you know, what we're seeing now is a recovery of a global music industry almost led by China, because China has no legacy and right, no vested interest and no
and is used to economic hardship in the music business.
There you go. But it's this vested interest where in the West, you know, for the last 10 years, we've seen we've seen fat cats and their lawyers basically try and sue the fuck out of anyone who's trying to innovate and take away. And it's just, it's an economic reality that's what happens. You know, people with vested interest are afraid of innovation.
Let's skip back to innovation then. Let's talk about the actual music that's being created here. Both Archie and Michael, both of you have said that, you know, you have great hopes for the local music scene. What is interesting about the music, new music being made in China at the moment?
I have something to say on this. I mean, I think one of the great things is, again, it's a sort of lack of legacy. You don't have these rigidly defined genres. You have bands that...
But, I mean, let's get to specifics, Kaiser. What are the interesting things coming out of the scene
I'm suggesting is that you have these bands that aren't constricted by allegiance to sort of the ideology of a particular genre. Let's take this band that we've mentioned before, Demerit, I mean, which I think you're both involved in. I played a show with them once. I was just astonished. I see these guys, one of them with a gigantic mohawk, with a sort of, Sex Pistols style font. They're obviously a punk-looking band, but they're wearing Iron Maiden T-shirts. They get up to soundcheck and they're playing Maiden songs. These guys have serious chops. They're really, really good. Aesthetically, they're a punk band, but then they play all these, extended guitar solos. And no punk band would ever do that.
And the hit on their record is actually an acoustic song, which
right.
is really interesting.
Right. And so, I mean, so they defy these sort of rigidly defined genres, and they're creating something that I think is really interesting because of its ability to transcend this.
Okay, Michael.
So I was involved in the New York music scene in the late 70s and early 80s, which is now looked back on as this important thing. And what I always remember, though, what always occurs to me is that if anyone had asked us back then what was going on, we would have had no idea of how to describe it. Nowadays, you look back on some of those bands and you say, yes, there clearly was a New York aesthetic of the late 70s and early 80s, and it's this, that, and the other. At the time, we had no idea of it. So when people ask me what's special, what's different about the Beijing music scene today, I can answer very abstractly and say some of the things that Kaiser has said. Because there's no legacy, because there's no history, it's incredibly enthusiastic, it's incredibly open, it's not really locked into genres.
It lacks pretension.
But lacks pretension, definitely. But none of that is very specific. And I don't think that's a problem. I think, you know, how do you describe it? Would we have known what heavy metal was in the early days of heavy metal? Did we really know how to describe the 1960s and 1967? No, we had no idea. 20 years from now, I have no doubt everyone will know exactly what the Beijing music scene was all about today. But all I know is that there's a lot of incredibly talented musicians, and they're coming. There are more and more young kids coming out with a level of sophistication that sometimes scares me. And there's just stuff happening.
And it's spreading through China. I mean, I don't think this is limited to Beijing anymore. I mean, you know, I'm based in Shanghai. We have an office in Beijing. You know, I'm well acquainted with both scenes.
Wuhan, for example,
In Wuhan. We work in Chengdu. We work in a lot of the
Kunming is another place with the scene.
Yeah, yeah. Xi'an has its own scene. Yeah. You know, Guangzhou doesn't, but God, that place is boring.
It used to have a really interesting scene. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
I think what's exciting coming out of China at the moment is there's an energy here that, you know, I think isn't necessarily present in you know, New York has the early strokes kind of, you know, it's petered out. London has the, you know, all these places have kind of established scenes and underground scenes, but at the moment in China, everything is emerging. You know,
Let me throw one thing in first too. Sure. There's another aspect of it too, and that sort of to me indicates how interesting and important the scene is likely to be, and that is that you go to London, you go to New York, Berlin, San Francisco, whatever. It's really cool to be, you know, in the underground music scene. And one of the results is that there are an awful lot of people who have absolutely nothing to do with music, but they're in the scene. And one of the things that I've noticed in China is that it really isn't cool yet to be part of the music scene. You don't say that, you know, I'm a musician and I played in Yugong Yishan, et cetera, and all your classmates and your parents and your teachers and your friends say, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
On the contrary, they look down on you. And so the result is that the only people who get involved in music, it seems to me, are people who are desperate about music.
But that is changing. But that is changing.
It's going to change. It's going to change as a function of the success.
It's already changing. And what I see is, you know, one of the reasons I came here is because I hate the music industry. And, you know, I love music and I wanted to be involved in music, but I couldn't.
But you know, Archie, if you and I are successful in what we're doing, we are going to destroy the golden age.
No.
That's part of the success.
No, of course, and then subcultures will spring up and hate us. And I've seen that. I mean, I'm sorry to denigrate maybe, but you know, I've seen a reaction to D22's success.
Sure.
I've seen a reaction to maybe Mars's success. You know, because let's face it, every human nature means that people love to hate. And if there's a success story, it's tall poppy syndrome. You know, maybe Mars is there, D22's there, everyone's talking about them, they're suddenly cool, and suddenly, you know, there are
but
people...
But don't you think that just exists because of the same problem that I was trying to say at the beginning of the show, which is that the scene, in fact, is not big enough. So you have relatively small groups of people who, you know, like
for
academics
sure.
fighting about obscure points of theory.
No, for sure, and I've written on my blog countless times about this idea that, you know, too many promoters, not enough fans. You know, which is a phenomenon that I think China's probably faced a number of times. You know,
it's where, deadly, right?
Yeah, it's deadly. Exactly. Where, and I'm sure it happened in punk and metal in the 90s, where, you know, this thing becomes a little bit of a juggernaut of its own. You know, albeit a relatively small juggernaut, and we're still in the phase of a small juggernaut, but suddenly it's cool and it reaches a sort of capacity
point,
and everyone jumps in and goes, wow. And then, you know, in China, because there is no critical mass at the moment, it peters out. And I think when you were talking about the 90s and when Michael was talking about the 2000s, I suddenly thought about this kind of step program almost, where it goes up really fast and then it plateaus, and then it goes up really fast and it plateaus.
We may be in a high rising period right now, and I think that's great. here's what I worry about. And I think we were talking about musicians themselves and musicianship. I think that there are a lot of bands. I think what the scene is sort of getting ahead of itself, where the enthusiasm of the musicians and their willingness to, you know, sort of be part of the scene has outstripped their actual ability to play their instruments. I think there are not enough people woodshedding on their instruments and actually, you know, learning to play. There's a lot of bands, I mean, pardon me, Michael, but, you know, who play at D22, who have very cool haircuts and ironic T-shirts and can't play, you know, more than the three chords necessary for their songs.
I they like masquerade bands that don't play very well.
Can I?
I mean, they don't have the chops.
Michael's the champion
of anti-technique, right?
Exactly. And here is a problem in China's music industry, and I would like to broaden industry outside of the industry that we've been talking about to include all music that goes on and is paid for in China. And the music that really makes money in China is state-funded music. Even the rock music that makes money, it seems from our conversation, a lot of it is festivals, which are funded by local governments. But if you want to make money as a musician, what you do is you play the violin very, very well, and you have a position either at an academy or at one of China's national orchestras, and you get a lot of money, and it's very comfortable. And these people have incredible, incredible chops. They have the real chops.
Right.
There's this huge gulf between those people and the indie scene, the alternative scene. But is there any sense that might ever converge?
It's Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. However you want to look at it, you know, you need time. You know, the kids who've been playing classical music have been playing classical music for 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. You know, because it's been trained for that long. You know. Probably the, you know, if you look at someone like Brain Failure, you know, the first time I saw Brain Failure, who are still playing, who one of the original punk bands who are still playing, they're f***ing good.
Yes, they are.
When they play, they're great showmen, they're great with their instruments.
But you talk to the guys in Brain Failure, though. I mean, I had a terrific moment with them. We were coming down in 2002 from the Lijiang, from Snow Mountain. We had soundchecked back-to-back. We rode in the van next to, you know, with them, us and, you know, long-haired metal guys with plain leather jackets and them, you know, with strangely colored hair and leather jackets covered in patches. And there was this strained silence for a while until one of their guitarists leaned across the aisle of the minibus and said, "Do you like Marshall amps?" And we started talking about this. And then they suddenly went into this gigantic revelation about they actually listened to all, you know, they listened to Steve Vai. They like Joe Satriani. They like all these
chops. Oh, sweet. Metal guys.
Exactly.
Okay.
We did a fisticuffs not long before. I mean, it was really...
I'm going to have to give a plea of support for poor musicianship. The idea that there's a perfect correlation or even a high correlation between musical virtuosity and musical quality is something that I don't agree with at all. For example, probably the greatest musical virtuoso produced in China is Lang Lang, but anyone who's serious about Beethoven would flee in horror from his interpretations. I don't think that's really the issue. Music is an art, and there's many ways to do it. You can do it in the form of...
That's a cop out. I mean, I think it's a huge cop out.
No, I don't think so.
I agree with Michael.
For me, the most important.
I think it's like trying to write literature without being literate.
The most important rock band. For me, the most important rock band in history was Velvet Underground, and it's very hard to argue that they were. Yeah, exactly. It's very hard to argue that they were musical virtuosos. Someone like Bob Dylan, who's the only one in my pantheon that ranks up there, was a great songwriter. He wasn't an especially good guitarist, and he had a terrible voice. So there's a lot of different things that music is supposed to do, and the idea that it's somehow highly correlated or limited to virtuoso performances is simply not true. There's no evidence of that
gentlemen, we're not going to have a theological argument because we're out of time. What we are going to do is the final little segment of the show where everybody gets to recommend something. And this week, I hope everybody has a music recommendation.
Sure.
Let's start with you, Archie.
Well, I have to. Can I recommend two?
Yes, absolutely.
Because
if you do it quickly, yes.
Okay, Omnipotent Youth Hotel, Omnipotent Youth Society, whichever one you want to call it, amazing bands. And I have to recommend Shanghai bands because I have to represent. We didn't cover Shanghai, but I have to represent Shanghai, and the big bands coming out of Shanghai you know, are quite expat. Fortunately, unfortunately, but they're influencing a new generation of Chinese bands. But Pears and Boys Climbing Ropes.
Duck Fight Goose,
yeah, I love them. But my personal favorites. Sorry, dude, I know you just signed them.
Signed right, Pears, too.
Michael, you're actually...
We've got Pears.
You've got an interesting problem, because I don't know, you know, if you pick one of your own bands... I think you might make political problems.
Let's make
yourself
a rule for Michael. He has to name a non-Maybe Mars band.
Okay, let's do that.
Non-Maybe Mars band. Jeez, that's tough.
They do have like 60 bands now.
I would say that this may be a little bit cheating because Bird Striking is a Maybe Mars band, but Hefan from Bird Striking.
No, you're cheating. Let's really go outside of your label here.
You know, I really love Hedgehog. It's the one band that we didn't sign that I really wish we had signed.
And that's a nice story. It's great when you have a label boss that has a band that wish they'd signed.
Okay, I had originally intended to plug Demerit, but they've already been plugged enough here. So I'm going to go with Suffocated, which is by my lights, just the most kick-ass metal band in Beijing. I mean, these guys have chops up the wazoo, but they're also incredibly good songwriters, and they put on a hell of a show. Full disclosure, we share a guitarist. Spring and Autumn shares a guitarist.
Hey, wait a minute.
So many conflicts of interest
there
in
are.
This show.
And they can be found on Baidu.
Well, it's going to get even worse because my recommendation is for my wife's new little single that she is selling online, Wu Fei, and it's called Paperboy.
Everyone's
got a
dog
in this fight. You can buy it on iTunes or Amazon.
And Omnipotent Youth Hoteller.
I'm sorry, what's it called?
It's called Paperboy. Her name is Wu Fei.
And Omnipotent Youth Hoteller are playing our festival, Black Rabbit Festival, Shanghai. 18th Beijing, 17th
So honestly, I'm the only guy who didn't cheat.
And Spring
Strike. You managed to mention Bird Strike.
Okay, enough.
Sunday
all
night
of you.
14th.
The musicians are a little too capitalist.
Right.
Thank you very much for joining our show, Archie and Michael. And thanks, Kaiser.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
You too.